Florida. No, I'm kidding. I believe, as the big book says, that my job is to express through my story how I formed a relationship with a God of my understanding, you know, and that's what I hope to do. And in order to do that, I'll tell you where it began. You know, I grew up in central New Jersey, in a town called Marlboro, and I grew up in a normal family, two loving parents, an older sister, a dog. You know, there was nothing in my childhood that I could point to and say this is the problem. But I wish I had something that I could say this, that I could blame my problem on. Because from a very young age, I had a problem and I didn't know what it was. And the best way I can describe it is, Chris Schroeder says it like this. I've heard him say it. It's like, I walked into kindergarten and I was a pint low. You know, I walked in there and I saw all the other kids running around having a good time, laughing, talking to each other, playing. These kids may or may not have ever met each other, but I certainly didn't know who they were. But they all looked like they knew what they were doing, and I was terrified. You know, I was absolutely terrified to talk to them. I was afraid that they were going to make fun of me. I was afraid I was going to wet my pants. I was afraid that, you know, I was full of self-centered fear at 4 or 5 years old, and I had no idea why. You know, long before I ever had a drink, I had a problem, and my problem was life. My problem was all of you, and how do I make you like me, you know? And I learned early on that I could find things that make me happy, and that's what I did. I'm obsessive. You know, when I was young, it was video games. You know, I would play video games. Like, I got Nintendo, and I played Super Mario Brothers, and, like, I beat it the first day, and I would get games. I'd want to beat it as soon as possible, you know? And as I got a little older, maybe it was food. I remember chocolate pudding. You know, my dad bought this, like, six-pack of Swiss Miss chocolate pudding. It was the first time I ever had it. Must have been 6 years old. I took one out of the fridge, and I went back and I ate another one. And I went back and I ate another one. I ate the whole thing of Swiss Miss chocolate pudding. And to this day, it kind of makes me sick to think about, like, of chocolate pudding, you know? And I'll eat it, but I don't, you know, it's... That's not abnormal behavior. It's not normal behavior to go back and eat an entire, like, six-pack of chocolate pudding. But what it did is chocolate pudding made me feel good, so I obsessed about it. You know, and a better example that most of us may relate to is that first song, that, you know, that my first favorite song. For me, it was Def Leppard, Pour Some Sugar on Me. And I got the single, and I listened to it. I rewound it. I listened to it again. I rewound it. I listened to it again. I did it over and over and over again. The song was awesome. I knew every single word. And by the end of the week, I hated that freaking song and I never wanted to hear it again. You know, and that's how I live my life. I find something that makes me feel good. I obsess about it until it stops working. And then I discard it. And I move on looking for the next thing. And in between, I'm left alone, empty, and broken. You know, and this is before I ever had a drink. You know, that's default map. And that's a scary place to live. You know, it sucks. You know, and... what I can tell you is I trudged on my horrible existence, right? You know, I trudged on through elementary school until I got to a point when I was about 12 years old. And I don't know why I felt this way, because like I said, I had nothing bad going on in my childhood. Looking back, it was awesome. You know, now in sobriety and reflecting and looking back at my childhood, it was awesome. But living it, I would have told you it was horrible. You know, and I have no idea why I felt that way. At the time, now I do, and I'll get to that in a bit. But what I can tell you is at 12 years old, I distinctly remember being in the kitchen of my parents' house, looking at the knife drawer and wishing I had the courage to slit my wrists. Because I knew that I had seen in some movie somewhere, that's what you do, you know? And I don't know why I felt that way. There was no logical reason for that. And thank God I'm a coward. I don't like pain. I don't like blood. And I closed the drawer and I ran away crying. And it was shortly after that I had my first drink. I don't know if it was a week, a month, 6 months. You know, after that, I had my first drink, and I'll never forget this experience. It was me and my buddy Chris in my parents' basement, and Chris, I'm still friends with Chris today, and he's not an alcoholic, and I learned that evening the way that he drank was very different than the way I drank. Our parents were both, our parents were friends, and they were out doing something, and our babysitter for the night was my grandmother. I loved my grandmother. She was awesome. She was the best babysitter ever. She didn't speak English. I don't speak Chinese. We got along really well. And it was really good. And so me and Chris were down in the basement. My parents had this fully stocked bar. And they didn't drink. They drank on holidays. You know, they drank at parties and barbecues and stuff. But, you know, know, they just had this fully stocked bar. I don't know why. And there was a bottle, and we took it off. It was open already. It was Canadian Club whiskey. And we went upstairs. We grabbed a bottle of orange juice and some styrofoam cups. And we went downstairs. We mixed them together. And it was probably 75% whiskey and 25% orange juice. And we didn't know what we were doing. We didn't use any ice. And we held our glasses up, and we cheered, and we tipped it back. And it was awful. It tasted so bad. But I'll never forget that feeling. You know, the initial feeling, we all know, you know, it burns. It hits your stomach. It burns, and it wants to come back up. I gagged a little bit, I think. And then I felt that warmth radiating out from my stomach and outwards into my fingertips and into my toes. I've heard it described that way. And the best way I can describe it is, thank God. Relief. My whole life, people have been telling me, Matt, you just need to relax. You just need to calm down. And I didn't know how to do that. And I got a drink in me, and I understood. You know, it's the weight of the world was lifted off my shoulders that night. And I didn't know I was carrying the weight of the world on my shoulders at 12 years old. My buddy Chris, he had that same big one sip. He might have gone back for a second sip, and he stopped. He's not an alcoholic. We had set out to try and experiment with alcohol. That was the goal for the evening, and that is exactly what Chris did. He tried and experimented with alcohol. He got a little buzz. He was good. He had enough. Me, I'm an alcoholic. I took that drink, and the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous describes it as a phenomenon of craving, an allergy to alcohol. The best way I can describe it is that I take a drink and I get thirstier. I take a drink and I can't stop. And I don't know when I'm going to stop. And I can promise you that I'm not going to, I'll finish this bottle of water tonight, and I'm not going to go out and buy a case of water and drink it all tonight. I can promise you that's not going to happen. If this was a beer, that's exactly what would happen. Every single time. And I don't know why that is. That's what makes me different from the normal drinker. You know, from my buddy Chris, who had two sips. I had the rest of my glass, I finished his glass, and I drank half a bottle of whiskey that night. I don't know, I was 85 pounds soaking wet. I blacked out, I passed out, I puked all over myself. I woke up the next morning with the worst hangover of my life. Never felt like that. Had the dry heaves for the first time. That was an awesome experience. Thought I was going to die. I did not know what that was. I was not prepared for the dry heaves. And of course, I'm like screaming to my grandmother that I'm dying, and she's yelling in Chinese, and she, you guys probably know this. Chinese people talk loudly, and they start getting exaggerated, and like, you know, it's like she was like yelling at me, but she was probably just trying to be like, what's wrong? And I was like, it was awesome. I'm laying there on the bathroom floor, and I'm saying that prayer, right? God, let me make it through this, and I'll never drink again. I promise I'll never drink again. And I'm not going to stand up here and lie and tell you that night I was ready to drink again. I wasn't. But very shortly thereafter, I don't know exactly how long, I was ready to drink again. Because that feeling, that relief I got, that, you know, because what happened is the next morning after, or the next day, whenever it was, once the hangover was over, and once I'm back to normal, that weight's back, and it's unbearable, and I can't live like that, and I obsess about things that work, and I remember, you know, I remember that feeling. Men and women drink because they enjoy the effects produced by alcohol, and a feeling so elusive, they follow it into the gates of death or something like that. They chase it into the gates of hell. That's exactly my story. I drink because I enjoy the effect produced by alcohol. The effect is so awesome, I will do anything to get that feeling. I will go through any kind of living hell to get that feeling. And at 12 years old, being so violently ill, I thought I was going to die, was living hell. And at the end of my drinking, losing everything that I'd ever worked for my entire life, being homeless and in and out of jail, in and out of rehabs, and, you know, not a friend or a friendly face in the world, that was the price I was willing to pay for my alcohol. I went on drinking. You know, I could stand here and I could tell you about that, and I'm going to give you some of the highlights, but I'm not going to talk about drinking for the full hour. But I will tell you that early on in my drinking career, it was whenever I could, however much I could, whatever I could, you know. And it was mostly alcohol, and when it wasn't alcohol, it was whatever I could get my hands on. You want to know why? Because I didn't care. You know, I didn't care. I'm an alcoholic, and my problem's not drinking. My problem's sober. You know, drinking is the solution. Sober is the problem, and I will do whatever I can to not be sober. And when you're 12 and you live in the suburbs in Jersey, it's not easy to go to the liquor store. So if I have to go to the guy around the corner behind school, I will. And I'll take whatever he's selling, you know, and it doesn't matter. It's just alcohol in another form, you know. And it wasn't every day. If it could have been, it would have been. I didn't have the money, the time, or the freedom to drink every day, you know. And when it was, when I could, it was every weekend, you know. And when it was every weekend, how the week went was, if I work real hard in school and I do my homework and I don't get into trouble, because my parents like to punish me, you know, because I was a troublemaker, you know. And if I was punished and grounded, I couldn't go out on the weekend. So all I had to do was stay out of trouble for the weekend, or stay out of trouble for the week, so I can go out on the weekend and I can drink the way I want to drink, you know. And as I got a little bit older, I got to just keep my grades up so they don't take away the car, you know, so that I can go out, with my friends. And I can do what I want on Thursday night, on Friday night, on Saturday night, you know. And it progressively just became, I just need to make it through this. And as long as I can make it through this, I can do what I need to do. Because it didn't matter what I had in my life. As I got older, it was work, right? You know, whatever it was, that was just a means to the end. It was, you know, life was unbearable. And all those things I'd do were a means so I could drink the way I wanted to drink. What ended up happening is I went away to college. Before I started drinking, I was a really good student. You know, I was like a straight A student, you know. I played the violin, and I was just a mama's boy. I started drinking, and I traded in the violin for the electric guitar, which I played really bad, really, really bad. I thought I was cool, but I was terrible at it. And I started doing, you know, I was terrible at school because I stopped caring. And I went from being like one of the top of my class to barely graduating high school. You know, I made it out by the skin of my teeth. And I honestly believe that a couple of my teachers in senior year, specifically my English and my gym teachers, passed me because they felt bad, because they didn't want me to stay behind. That's the honest truth, because I didn't show up ever my senior year of high school. And I applied to like 7 schools because that's what my parents wanted me to do. And I got into one. And it was awesome because it was NJIT in Newark, New Jersey. Growing up in the suburbs, budding alcoholic, under a strict rule of my parents, nothing was better than getting to go to Newark and moving to Newark for my first taste of freedom, because I could do whatever I want, whenever I want, and there was no one there to watch me. And I thought that was awesome. And what happened is, unlike high school, colleges don't care so much, the teachers don't care, no one cares. You got to show up and you got to do your work, and if you don't, that's your problem. And because it was my first taste of freedom, I promptly failed out of college. My first semester, I passed calculus only because I took it in high school, and I just showed up for the test. I failed all my other classes, and then my second semester, I failed every class, and they kicked me out. I don't even know what my GPA was. It was less than a 1. You know, it was low. And I got kicked out of school. And what actually happened was, in about April, I had a bad night. And I had a moment of clarity that I was getting kicked out of school. I was getting kicked out of the dorms. And I called my mommy. And I said, please help me. You know, come get me. I wasn't homeless, because, like, I still lived at home with my parents. But I thought I was, like, on my own. You know, I thought I was independent because I wasn't living under their roof. I was at school living in the dorms. So I'm like, you know, I'm about to be homeless. And I'm going to get kicked out of school. And my life is unbearable. And I said, I had enough. I need to quit. Please, like, come help me and send me to rehab. And my parents, God bless them, they tried and they cared and they've been through the ringers with me. And they did. They sent me to rehab. I went to a rehab in my hometown in Marlboro, New Jersey. And it was back when it was in the old psych hospital. And they built a new building next door now. But back then it was in the psych hospital. And, like, you know, I get in there. And it's in – the bedrooms are, like, these rooms with, like, the doors that close. They don't lock because it wasn't a psych hospital anymore. But it's one of those doors that close and there's no handle on the inside. And it was, like, just creepy. You know, the day room had the black and white checkered tile floor. And I felt like I was in, like, the movie, like, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And it was, like, I'm in there. And after I detoxed for the first few days, I was an 18-year-old kid. And I'm in there, and I'm listening to the stories. And I'm sure people were bringing the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sure that there was a message of Alcoholics Anonymous somewhere being told. But all I was hearing was driving cars through houses and running from the police and losing jobs and like blowing up gas stations. I don't know, like all these like extravagant stories of alcoholism. And I'm like, I didn't do any of that crap. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm just a good kid from the suburbs. I drink a little too much. You know, those other things, those other substances, those are the problems. You guys, you clearly need Alcoholics Anonymous. This is for you. This is not for me. Thank you very much for the information. I'll see you later. You know, and what happened was I got out of trouble for just long enough to get my act together, just enough to change my mind. You know, and it's like 4 days earlier, I wanted help. And here I am in this rehab, and I don't want help anymore. You know, and I checked myself out at AMA because, you know, I was able to just call my buddies up from high school and be like, come pick me up. I'm over here. I'm 520. Come get me. You know, and they came and they got me, and I partied for a couple of days, and my parents got wind of the fact that I checked myself out of this rehab, and they care. They picked me up, and they, like, kept me under lock and key, and they sent me to one of these, like, spa daycare rehabs out in Minnesota, you know, where it's easy to do 28 days, you know, because I didn't want to do it in that other place, and I did in this place, and it was like, all right, you know, everyone's young, rich, and beautiful, and, you know, here's your $30,000 big book, and a pat on the butt to A. When it was done, I was like, thank you very much for the information, and I went to a halfway house, and I drank on my first day out. You know, I stayed sober for 28 days because I was under lock and key, and I left, and I went to a halfway house, and I drank on the first day out, and those 28 days were the longest I was going to stay sober for the next 7 years. And it's not for lack of trying, because somewhere in there, I got the desire to stop drinking. You know, what happened is I moved out to Minnesota because I went to rehab, and I stayed. I stayed because I was far enough away from my parents that they couldn't control me. You know, and that's the reason I stayed, freedom. You know, because all I've ever wanted was the freedom to drink the way I drink. Because here's what I know. My life is unbearable. Alcohol is the solution, right? And I drink in a way that makes the people around me question the way I drink. You know, my friends question the way I drink. My family certainly questions the way I drink. My employers question the way I drink. My girlfriends question the way I drink. Everyone questions the way I drink. And what I've learned is if you're going to get in the way of my drinking, I'm going to get rid of you. Because you stand between me and the only thing that matters. So the solution, stay in Minnesota. Tell my parents I'm doing great. I'm living in this halfway house. They told me to stay. You know, and that's exactly what I did. And I left that halfway house. I was there 3 months. I graduated, you know, and I got sent off to a 3/4 way house. And, you know, I did that for however long until I was able to get an apartment, and I just stayed. And I built this life in Minnesota. I worked waiting tables, and I thought I was doing awesome. And it was just a mess. You know, my life was just a mess. Just now drinking every day. And I built it up. I spent a year or two doing that and getting enough things, right? Because here's what I thought at that point in my life. My problem is that I don't have the things. I need the things. I need the money. I need the cars. I need the house, the wife, the dog, all this crap. If I get all this stuff, then I'll be happy. Then I won't have to drink this way, you know? And then I get all that crap, and it's too much stress, and it's like, obviously I have to drink this way because look at how much stuff I have to deal with, you know? And it's like, come on, you know? And it's like, you know, it's Arbor Day. Of course I'm drinking. It's Arbor Day. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't matter. I always have a reason to drink. Because drinking is what it's all about. Drinking solves every problem. And what happens is I get all those things, and then I used to say I lost them. I didn't lose anything. I gave it all away, you know? Because that boss at that job that I was making decent money at, he wanted me to show up every day on time and put in a full day's work. I mean, what nerve, you know? That wife, she wanted me to come home at the end of the day with my paycheck, you know? Screw her. You know, that car, it's got to be registered, and I got to have a license and insurance, and the police want me to, like, you know, obey the laws. F them. You know, and the mortgage, I mean, that's just, come on. I don't have time to pay a mortgage. I got tabs to pay. You know, so everything in my life that I lost, I willingly gave up because it got in the way of my drinking. It's a very common theme in my life, you know? And I tear my life down, and I get into some trouble. I lose some stuff. I get into some legal trouble. I get into this kind of trouble. The heat is on. Okay, I need to quit drinking. Now, mind you, I've been in rehab. I know what AA is, and I know what you people talk about. You quit forever. I'm not in for that. But I just need to quit long enough to maybe get my act together, you know, get the police off my back, and then I'll be okay. You know, and it was always the same. This is what would happen. The first couple of days suck. There's no way around it. When you're poisoning your body on a regular basis, and you take that poison away, there's going to be effects, you know? And those first few days of detoxing suck. And after that, you actually start to get a lot better. You know, physically, you start to get healthier. And so after the first few days, I'm patting myself on the back. Look at me. I'm sober. I got money in my pocket. I'm telling my friends, you know, this is awesome. By the end of a week, I'm a new man. You know, I've turned over a new leaf. Life is awesome. I'm going to do all this stuff. I'm going to work out. I'm going to get in shape. I'm going to quit smoking, whatever. And by the end of 2 weeks, God, my freaking shoelace is untied. God damn it. You know, and it's like, there's traffic on the road. Who do these people think they are? I got to go somewhere. Get the hell out of my way. And it doesn't matter what it is. Everything in life becomes so unbearable. Every little detail of life becomes so unbearable. The only thing I know to do to make that go away is have a drink. I have a drink. Okay. Unfortunately, I drink and the phenomenon of craving sets in and I can't stop. And I drink until the consequences of drinking pile on and get so unbearable that I know I have to stop because I've got warrants, I've got tickets, I've got girl problems, I've got financial problems, I've got job problems. I have to quit drinking, at least for a little bit. And I stop. And I stop until the pain of sobriety gets so bad that I have to drink. And I repeat over and over and over again. And that's what I did for 7 years, living in Minnesota. I just cycled, you know, and I don't think I could say it better than the big book says it. You know, the alcoholic couldn't imagine life with or without alcohol. He was at the jumping off place. He wished for the end. You know, and that's precisely where I was, at the jumping off place, and I wished for the end. Because I knew from my own experience, what do we talk about here? Our experience, right? From my own personal experience, I knew I could not live sober. I could not do it. And I knew I could not go on drinking. There's only one alternative, you know, and it's that same one I found that I thought about at 12 years old, and I was still the same wuss at 26, you know, that I was at 12, and I took some pills, and, you know, I don't think I took enough, and I think I intentionally didn't take enough, you know, and my girlfriend at the time found me, and she called the ambulance, and I vaguely remember getting in the ambulance, getting the ride to the hospital, and then I woke up, I was strapped to the bed, one of those deals, and that was an experience, you know, and it's, I wake up in the ER strapped, and I start screaming and pulling, and they put me in the private room, you know, the one with no handle on the inside that I can't open, that was an interesting realization that that's where my life ended up, and that's probably where I should be, right? And they let me use the phone, and I remember calling up that girlfriend who was a mental health professional. Actually, she was a good alcoholic too. She drank like I drank, and she worked. She had some kind of degree, and she was able to convince the doctors, the nice doctors and nurses of Hennepin County Medical Center, that they should release me into her care as a trained professional. That I was no danger to myself or anyone else. That she would take care of me. And I don't know if I was in there a day or 3 days or a week. I really don't know. It was probably 2 hours. You know what I mean? Like, you know, alcohol, I have a tendency to exaggerate things. It was probably just a couple of hours, but it felt like forever. And they let me out into her care. And I got into her car, and I was like, to the bar. You know? And here I am. And the point I want to make is just getting out of the flight deck, just getting out of the loony bin for an attempted suicide. And that was like no joke. I wanted to kill myself, and that's where I was at. And I get out, and let's go to the bar, of course. What else would I do? I need a drink. Let's get me a drink. And like I said, she was an alcoholic, and she's just like, let's go. You know, and it didn't take much longer after that everything started coming down. I was getting evicted from my apartment. My car was all smashed up. I had this car, and it didn't run because it was a nice car. It was still like, it was only like a year old. But I crashed it and I didn't have insurance and the radiator was cracked. And so it just sat there and I was like, I can live in my car. That's my plan. But this is Minnesota, mind you, in December. You guys laughing, you know, it's like below zero in December in Minnesota. So that lasted all of like 15 minutes. And I did what every good alcoholic does. I did what I do best. I picked up the phone and I called my mommy. And I said, Mom, I need help. You know, and here I am, 25 years old. And my mom flew out across the country. You know, God bless this woman. She picked me up. And she packed all my stuff up and drove back. It was the most miserable 24-hour drive from Minnesota back to New Jersey. And she drove me back and moved me in with her. And that's where I spent the last year of my drinking in my mom's apartment in northern New Jersey. She had this beautiful condo on the Hudson River looking at, you know, the skyline of New York. My bedroom, like, you know, and I had a panoramic view of New York City. And I didn't have a care in the world, and I just lived with her. I didn't have any bills to pay. I didn't have any expenses. And she asked me to pay her like $100 a week, you know, and I couldn't even do that. You know, and it's not that she needed the money. She did it to try to get me some sense of responsibility. And I couldn't even do that because all I could do was drink. You know, and my last year of drinking is a blur. I made amends in early sobriety to the guy I drank with that last year. He's not an alcoholic. He's just a good friend of mine from growing up. And he was in the city, living in the city at that time, living in the village. So I would take the jitney, it's a 2-hour bus into the city, and I'd go meet him. And we'd go out drinking until the bars closed at like 4 in the morning. And we'd go back to his place and you know, whatever. And then I'd head up to Harlem and get something else. And I'd be out all night, you know. And then I would do it again the next day. And I have no recollection of ever making it home. I somehow made it home every night. I have no idea how. And when I made amends in sobriety to this man, he's like, you went out after that? He's like, we were so wasted every night. I'm like, of course I went out. Like, we were so wasted for you. Because, you know, like, for me, I don't stop drinking until I pass out or am out of money or I'm in jail. Like, you know, you have to physically stop me from drinking. I will keep drinking until I cannot drink anymore. And that was my last year of drinking. And what ended up happening is I found myself, my mom had that 16th-floor apartment. And I actually found myself sitting on the windowsill of my bedroom, looking down, and just cursing myself for not having the courage to jump. You know, I wanted it so badly to end. You know, and my mom came in and she saw me sitting there, and she called the police and the ambulance, and they came, and they sat, and I'll never forget this moment. The firemen got there first, right? And so they talked me in. And I think actually a big part of the reason I came in is there was a lot of drugs in my room, and I knew the cops weren't far behind them, and I didn't want to get arrested. So like I came in and I locked my bedroom door, and I came out and I'm sitting on the living room couch, and they're talking to me, and these firemen, they're like, you know, maybe you just need to find a purpose. Maybe you should be a fireman, because then you could help. And they're like, then you could help people, you know, and maybe that's an answer for you. And I don't know if they were alcoholic or if it's just coincidence that they said that, you know, but how right they were. They were just a little bit off on what I should be doing, but helping people was they weren't far off on that. You know, and what ended up happening is the ambulance got there. They put me in the back of the ambulance, take me to St. Mary's Hospital in Hoboken, and they're going with the sirens, right? And it's like 6 in the morning. And so I'm thinking, you know, I hope the neighbors didn't see me. You know, I hope the neighbors didn't wake up. That's kind of embarrassing. Are the sirens really necessary? They're really loud. You know, and I'm like, wow, man, what does the concierge think? You know, and here I am, again, wanting to kill myself. And all I could think about is what everyone else thinks about me. You know? And I had no idea of anything other than I had no idea who I was or what was going on. And what ended up happening is I got to that hospital. They didn't keep me, and I was in Hoboken, New Jersey, and I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And God willing, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, a newcomer, for the last time. And I didn't come back because I wanted to. I didn't come back because I liked you people. I didn't come back because I thought it was a good idea. I came back because I had nowhere else to go. You know? I had nowhere else to go. My mom, I mean, I was living with her, but she didn't, I was living with her because she didn't want me to be homeless. You know, that's the only reason that she tolerated me. you know, and there was no one else in the world that would have done that for me, you know, and I went back to AA, and I came in begrudgingly, and I sat in your stupid meetings, and I drank your stupid coffee, and I ate your stupid cookies, and I was pissed, right? Because this is, I went to a lot of discussion meetings, and they were good discussion meetings. People were sharing a message, but they were happy. And they were happy because they had a solution in their life, right? But me, a alcoholic, brand new in AA, without a solution, without a drink, counting my days, I was miserable. And I'm not happy that you're freaking happy. I'm not happy for you that you got your life together. I'm not happy for you that you got your wife back or your job back or your car and your house. I hope you drive that car after work into that house where your wife and your whole family is, and I hope it all freaking blows up. You know, because that's where I am. Misery loves company, right? You know, and that's where I was, not, you know, brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm coming to the meetings, and I was miserable. And I was doing the same thing I always did. I was gonna make it through a 2 weeks and drink, you know? And what ended up happening is I took a series of actions for all the wrong reasons, but those actions changed my life. And that's really what I want to talk about, because Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, is a program of action. So there's this one meeting up in that area in northern New Jersey. It was a young people's meeting. I'd been to it the week before, so I'm about 2 weeks sober now, and I'm ready for a drink. I'm primed, and I'm ready for a drink. But I needed to get out of the house. I wasn't working anymore. I was living with my mom, and I wasn't allowed to go anywhere unless I went to an AA meeting. So I'm like, can I borrow your car? I'm going to an AA meeting. There's this meeting over here. It's a young people's meeting. I'm going to go there. And my thinking is, you know, I remember there was a lot of girls there. You know, I'm like, so I can go there, maybe I can find a date. That's, you know, my delusional thinking. And I go to this AA meeting, and there were these people. It was a speaker discussion meeting, and there were some speakers there that I traveled quite a distance to go to speak at this meeting, and I don't really know why. I didn't really know any of this before the meeting. But they did this thing where before the meeting they said, you know, would anyone here be willing to be a sponsor, to temporary sponsor to people? And some people raised their hand, and I do what I always do. I picked someone out all the way across the room, right? So that there's no way I'm really going to talk to them after the meeting's over. So the meeting happens, and I raise my hand, I share some crap because I want people to like me. Then we're doing the Lord's Prayer. Lord's Prayer's over, and I turn for the door. And this guy that I picked out all the way across the meeting, he was standing next to me. I'm like, holy crap. You know, like, how did that happen? And, like, he was between me and the door, which is a trick I learned, which is really important. When you stand next to a newcomer during Lord's Prayer, between them and the door, because that's the way they turn. You know, and I turned to him, and he's like, hey, what's going on? You know, and he's like, do you have a sponsor? And I'm like, this guy's way too happy. And I'm like, no. And I don't know why I said no. But he's like, I'll be your sponsor. And I was like, okay. And I don't know why I said okay. You know, but it was the best thing I've ever said in Alcoholics Anonymous, saying okay. And it continues to be the best thing I say in Alcoholics Anonymous. When my sponsor gives me a direction, I say okay. And it's always awesome. I never think it's awesome when I say okay. I'm always questioning, why am I saying okay right now? But it always works out really well. And this was no different. So this guy, you know, okay, you're going to be my sponsor. He's like, all right, let's go. And he hands me a big book. And we step outside. And he's like, this is what we're going to do. We're going to get together. We're going to go through this book. We're going to work the steps. It's going to be awesome. I'm like, oh, my God, I made a big mistake. You know, like, what is going on here? And he starts pointing to these other guys that he's with. There's all these people. He traveled there with, like, 15 people. I'm like, what the heck? You know, and he's, like, introducing me. Like, this is it. And I'm like, okay, what's going on? He's like, we get together every day. We meet here. We go to meetings. You know, we share. We tell our stories. And I'm like, okay. And I'm overwhelmed. And he's like, listen, what are you doing tomorrow? And I'm like, nothing, you know, because I don't know about you. But when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not have a lot going on. You know, I did not, as one of my sponsors said in early sobriety, when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not have a very busy social calendar. And he said, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, nothing. He said, okay, meet us here. And what I heard, so I went to this meeting because I was looking for a date. I didn't find a date. I got a sponsor. And then the sponsor told me to meet him tomorrow. And what he was doing is he was doing what a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous does. He reached his hand out to the newcomer and basically said, come do what I do. You want to get sober? I've got an answer. Follow me and I'll show you what to do. What I heard him say was like, these are all my friends. He introduced, you know, a bunch of people that I might have drank with some of these guys. That's kind of what I got. These guys, some of them seemed all right. And what he was saying to me is, hey, we like you. We would enjoy the presence of your company tomorrow. If you would meet us here, we would love to hang out with you because you seem like a cool guy. You know, and that's what I heard. And so I said, okay, I will grace them with my presence. And I show up tomorrow, you know. I show up that next day, and we go to a meeting. We get in a car, and we drive to a meeting, and they're speaking at this meeting. I'm like, what the heck? You know, and the whole way down, they're talking about AA, 12 steps, God. At the meeting, AA, the 12 steps, God. In the car back, AA, the 12 steps, God. And I'm like, God damn it, can't we just talk about baseball? You know, like, what, you know, and it's like every day the same thing. You know, but what happens is, you know, they say, let's do it again tomorrow. Okay, yeah, sure. You want to hang out with me? No problem. And what happened was, I'm a people pleaser. I want you to like me. And my whole life, I've had no identity. I've just, like, glommed on the identity of whoever I'm hanging out with, right? And so these guys, all they're doing is AA in the 12 steps. So I'm going to do the 12 steps. Not because I think they're a good idea. Not because I want to. Not for any reason other than I want these guys I'm hanging out with to like me. And this is what they're doing. And this is what they're talking about. So when they're talking about it, I want to be able to add something to the conversation and have them not think I'm an idiot. You know, so I started working through that book with that sponsor. And I got some results. You know, and I did it all for the wrong reasons. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, I did it. And what ended up happening is, I don't know how long it took me to go through the steps. 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, somewhere in that ballpark. The first year of sobriety was a big blur. But what I do know is at one point, I reflected and I was sober 4 or 5 months. And like I said, I had never been sober more than 28 days. And I was like, holy shit. You know, and like something was happening and I was relatively happy about being sober. I went to the meetings and people were talking about how good their life was. And I was like, that's really cool. You know, I didn't want people to go home and die anymore. Like that was a big improvement in my life, you know, like, I started going to meetings. I started sharing my story and I was that jackass with the big smile on my face in the front of the meeting that I know there's some newcomer who's with, you know, sending death daggers at me, you know, but it's like, that's okay. Cause I'm happy. You know, and wow, what a change, you know, and I would love to talk about the 12 steps in detail, but that's not my job tonight, I don't think. I think my job, well, what happened from the 12 steps, by doing the 12 steps, which boil down to nothing more than this: trust God, clean house, help others, right? I had a whole new relationship with a God of my understanding. I had a God of my understanding in my life, you know, for the first time ever. And from that point, when I had gone through my first pass of the steps, the answer has always been the same. I have a problem, whatever the problem is, my sponsor says, you know, what did you do today to help someone? What did you do today to help another alcoholic? How many guys are you sponsoring? You know, did you pray today? How are you with God? You know, and these are always the things he says. And so at 6 months sober, when I had a crappy job and a crappy apartment, I moved out of mom's house finally. I was renting a room in some lady's house, and I had this Volvo station wagon. Let me tell you, this thing was awesome because it was like 2006, 2007 now, and I had a 1990 Volvo station wagon. And it was three different colors because it had, like, you know, different quarter panels from other vehicles. It had four different hubcaps or rims on the car. They weren't even hubcaps. They weren't like nice rims, just like steel ones, you know? And the fabric on the inside, like the ceiling fabric, was like coming down. And like the foam was like, it would like rain down this yellow foam on top of you. And the car had 200,000 miles. It shook, rattled, and barely rolled. And I drove that thing all over the state of New Jersey going to AA meetings, you know, picking up newcomers and just going to meetings and speak. And that it was crazy. And that thing, I'm thinking I need a new car. I'm thinking I need a new place to live. I'm thinking I need a new job. I was still single, so I'm thinking I still need a girlfriend. And I'm 6 months sober, and I started focusing on those things. So job, girlfriend, car, stuff. And I'm looking for all of them on Craigslist, by the way. And that was not advisable. You know, and what ended up happening is, in very short order, I didn't drink, but I got squirrely. I got uncomfortable in sobriety. I started having a lot of bad days, you know, and I'll never forget. I called my sponsor. I'm like, Steve, I don't know. I think I want to drink. And for a while now, I've been saying crap like that, and he had been giving me suggestions that I wasn't taking. So his answer this time was, well, you know, what do you drink? Whiskey? I'll bring you a bottle. And I was like, that son of a bitch, you know, because I wanted him to coddle me. You know, I wanted him to be like, it'll be okay, don't worry, you know. And he's like, I'll bring you a bottle. And he's like, if you want my help, he's like, there's a speaking commitment in this town, go there, you know. And he hung up the phone. And I was like, jerk, you know. And I got in that car and I drove. It was an hour away. It was Lakewood. And I drove. And I'm 6 months sober, right? I get into this meeting. And I don't know. There was like 300 people. There's probably 100. Probably 50. But it seemed like 300 people, you know? Like, and they all had like 50 years sober, you know? Like, this is of course what it seems like to me. And I'm like, I'd never spoken for an hour. I'm here. It's an hour long meeting. I'm the only one there from my group. And I'm like, oh, geez, you know? Like, what am I going to do? And I said a little prayer and I went up and I shared my story to the best of my ability with the attempt of trying to help someone, you know? And what happened is some sick guy came up to me at the end of the meeting, and he must have been real sick because he asked me to sponsor him, you know. And I thank God for that from every moment for that guy and for that meeting and for that direction for my sponsor to go do that. Because what happened? This is the first guy that I sponsored that stuck around. He's still sober today. I don't sponsor him anymore. He lives in Vegas. Bob Darrell's a sponsor. You know, guy's on fire. He sponsors like a million guys. But I sponsored him for like 2 months, and it was awesome because the guy was ready to get sober. And what he did is he was willing, and he called me every day, you know, and he was like, you know, where are we going today? What are we doing? And what happened? I wasn't going to go to the meeting, but I guess we're going here. Meet me here, you know? And it's like, and sponsorship saves my ass when I don't want to be saved. Because when I sponsor guys, it makes me think about AA. And it pulls me into AA, and it makes me do things that I don't want to do, you know. And then I'm working with this guy, and so all of a sudden I'm back in AA. You know, I never left, but I wasn't doing it the way I was, you know, early on. And I'm back in doing it again. I'm working with this guy, and I'm going through the steps. I'm taking him through the steps, and you can't take someone through steps without going through them yourself, you know. And here I am, and I'm going through these steps again, and we're doing his fourth step, and I'm sharing stuff from my. We're doing his fifth step, and I'm sharing stuff from my fourth step, you know. And I'm. Things that I didn't even want to tell my sponsor the first time around. I was never going to tell anyone else. I'm telling it to this guy. And I'm having a whole new experience with a step by taking someone else through it. You know, what ended up happening is while I was sponsoring this guy, I got a new apartment. I got a new job. I didn't get a girlfriend. But, you know, but I did get a new car because the other one, I hit a deer. And I was on the highway. I lived in Minnesota for 7 years. I don't think I saw a deer. I was on Route 22 in, like, Union, New Jersey, and I hit a deer and totaled my car. And my cousin gave me a car. Just gave it to me, you know? And I was trying to help someone out in my home group that needed a place to live. So I went from that room I was renting to, an apartment in, like, a house. Like, it was, like, a two-bedroom apartment kind of thing in, like, a house in, like, Orange, New Jersey, which any of you know, New Jersey, it's not a good town. But it was, like, I went out of my way, and I got this apartment I couldn't afford so I could move someone in with me who needed a place to live. And what ended up happening is I went to work the next day. I was a temp at this pharmaceutical company because I failed out of college 7 times. I didn't talk about that, but I failed out of college 7. I stopped going to college 7 times. They kicked me out 7 times. I just stopped going, you know. And I was a biochem major. I was like, I have like 130 credits. I still don't have a degree. I have like 130 credits, which is more than enough for a degree, but they're all these different schools. And so my sponsor told me, I was an out-of-work bartender when I got sober. My sponsor said, get a job in your field. So I got a job working as a temp at a major pharmaceutical company. And it was a crappy job. And I get this apartment. I can't afford it, you know. And I got this car that my car is all, you know. I go into work one day after I'm like... I'm doing all kinds of things to help other people. I'm sponsoring this guy, and I get this apartment, and I go into work, and the department head pulls me. I don't even know who this guy is. You know, this guy is like a big shot in the industry, and he pulls me to his office like, hey, Matt. And I'm walking. I'm on my way to go smoke a cigarette. This guy pulls me in his office. He's like, you know, I hear that you're pretty good with computers. I hear that you have a biochemistry background, and it sounds like your car is always breaking down, and you're always fixing it, which is a true story. He's like, we got this job working with these robots. do you think you'd be interested? And I was just like, what? You know, and I was like, yeah, sure. And like that, I went from being a temp to having like a permanent job. I had like a 401k, a salary. Like, my job title was scientist. I worked in that company. Now I'm an engineer now somehow. I'm a robotics engineer. I still don't have a college. I have no idea how any of this happened. The only thing I know is I was an out-of-work bartender, and I applied the same principles that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous to work. I show up early. I try to help people. I work hard, you know, and I help people I help people in AA. And what happens? The reason I tell you all these things is the Big Book has this great line. Somewhere in there in the third step, it says, we had a new employer. Being all powerful, if we kept close to him, performed his work well, he provided for us. So I'm paraphrasing it. I butchered it. But it's something like that. And that's what I experienced in my life. When I stay close to God and try to do his will, which I don't know God's will, but I can tell you what, Matt's will was not driving an hour and a half to Pennsylvania to come speak at a meeting tonight. Matt's will was sitting at home doing homework in an online class. So I'm trying to get that degree that I still don't have. That would have been my will, would have been staying at home tonight. You know. But God's will, I don't know what it is, but this has got to be closer to God's will than Matt's will. It's got to be. I'm trying to help another alcoholic. You know. And as long as I do those things, what happens is God takes care of me. Those things in life, they work out. When I'm trying to fix it, when I'm trying to get the new job, when I'm trying to get the new this, the new that, whatever it is, I don't get it. I make things worse. I get crazy. When I try to help you, things work out. That's repeated itself for the last 10 years in my sobriety. Whatever the problem is, I call my sponsor. Doug, this is what's going on. It's blah, 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 blah. Vomit. How many guys are you sponsoring? You know, how are you, you know, how have you gotten closer to God today? And I'm just like, come on. You know, like, I want a better answer than that. There's got to be, you know, and it's click, you know, and it's like, all right, go help another alcoholic. Everything works out. You know, my life is awesome today. You know, forget the job, forget the house and, I mean, I got those things. That's not what AA promises, you know. That's just nice stuff that, like, hard work has, you know, because of AA, I've been able to put some things together and do that. I have a daughter. She's here tonight. She's 8 years old. She's awesome. She's never seen me drink. You know, I have a beautiful girlfriend that supports me and is here tonight, and my life is awesome. You know, I walk past the mirror. I see myself, and I don't shield my eyes. You know, I'm not upset with who I am. You know, I get to come to places like this and, you know, share my story. You know, and I said it before the meeting. You know, when I was drinking, I was never invited anywhere. You know, unless on holidays, especially unless I was like, I became the guy who threw the party. Not because I don't like entertaining at all. I never entertain now. The reason I threw the party is because otherwise I'd be alone. You know, like I had to throw the party with all the beer and all the drugs. Otherwise you wouldn't invite me to your house. You know, so now I get invited places. You know, and just this weekend, you know, there was a party in our neighborhood and there was some commotion and there was some stuff going on. And long story short, my daughter wanted her friend to come sleep over, and like we had all this stuff, and like the father of her friend said sure, you know. And then like her sister wanted, I had like the neighborhood kids like at my house, and like parents trust me to like let their children like spend the night at my house, and I won't think like the house won't burn down. When I was drinking, the house burning down was a real possibility, you know. And like people trust me now to like watch their kids, you know. And it's like that's amazing. I don't deserve this kind of life. You know, of and by myself, I'm a out-of-work bartender who can't keep a job, can't do anything, can't pay my rent, can't insure my vehicle. I have a vehicle now that has been made in my current period of sobriety. It's registered, insured, and I have a driver's license, and all the addresses match. You know, that's amazing. You know, like, that's a miracle for a guy like me. I'm gonna sit down, but I want to end with this. And I heard Sandy Beach say this, and it's so true. a lot of you guys, you know, you guys have it here. This is an awesome meeting. I love this meeting. You know, it's great. Thank you for having me. You guys get this deal. But if there's anyone out here in the audience tonight that is new, this is parts for you, right? If you're new and you haven't worked the steps and you're miserable and you're sitting there and you want me to just shut up and sit down, you know, and you're like, and I'll tell you, basically what I said tonight was get a sponsor, do the steps, stop drinking, get a sponsor, do the steps, your life will be awesome. That's the gist of AA, right? I was in AA meetings for a lot of years and I heard that. Quit drinking, get a sponsor, do the steps, your life will be awesome. And excuse my language, in my head, I always said, bullshit. Doesn't make any sense, bullshit. It's too simple. It's too simple. I don't get it, doesn't make any sense. It's a lot like drinking, right? If you would have came up to me before I had that first drink at 12 years old, and you would have said, Matt, I know this stuff smells bad. I know it tastes bad. I know when you drink it, it makes you want to vomit. I promise you, if you drink enough of this stuff called alcohol, you will feel like Dick Clark in Times Square on New Year's Eve. You will be the center of the universe. You'll be able to dance. You'll be able to talk to girls. Your life will be awesome. All you have to do is drink enough of this stuff called alcohol. If you would have told me that before I had a drink, I would have said, bullshit. Doesn't make any sense. No way. Once I drank, I understood. Alcoholics Anonymous, 12 steps are the same way. For years, you gave me this very simple set of tools. Just do this. Your life will be awesome. 7 years, I suffered. I didn't do it. I did it in a matter of months, and I've been on fire ever since. Life's not perfect, but life is freaking great. I hope I brought you a good meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.